Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Conquer We Must, A Military History of Britain, 1914 to 1945, by Robin Pryor. Narrated by Liam Gerrard. Introduction. In the 20th century, it fell to Britain to confront a number of regimes which represented a threat to the civilized world. Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were two of the blackest regimes ever to darken the pages of human history. The Nazis, with their expansionism, militarism, and vile racial policies, could not be endured or even tolerated because their thirst for conquest was virtually unlimited. There was no chance of peaceful coexistence with them. The very presence of democratic, liberal states was sufficient provocation for Hitler to foment a war. The Germany of the Kaiser, while it had some seemingly democratic credentials in terms of the franchise and welfare system, was in fact expansionist, militaristic, and anything but liberal. Its domination of Europe would not, as some commentators have suggested, have resulted in some form of premature common market, but in the snuffing out of liberal values in Western Europe, and when Tirpitz had got around to outbuilding the British fleet, in Britain as well. Italy was once an ally of Britain and a democracy of a kind, but under Mussolini gradually succumbed to fascism and illiberalism. From the moment the Pact of Steel with Hitler was announced, oppression increased, and by its end, the regime was an accomplice to genocide. Japan had also been an ally of Britain, but from the 1930s descended into its own form of fascism, as became brutally apparent with the rape of Nanking and the barbaric medical experiments inflicted on the Chinese people. And its war against China was only a stepping stone to wider ambitions across the Pacific basin. Taking the two world wars together, Britain was the only power on the Allied side to fight these regimes from beginning to end. And, given the nature of the powers that it was fighting, it was essential that any chance of a liberal world order, however imperfect, emerging with peace, depended on Britain being on the winning side. What struck me in examining Britain in these wars was the implacable nature of its effort. There was never any doubt that Britain would strive with every fibre of its being to see both wars through to successful conclusions. The Defence of the Realm Act in 1914 and the Emergency Powers Act of 1939 to 1940 swept away many of the civil liberties that had been won at such cost over the centuries, with hardly a murmur from the general population. Politicians, thought not to be up to the rigours that such wars engendered, such as Asquith and Chamberlain, were replaced with more resolute premiers in Lloyd George and Churchill. Similarly, military leaders such as Sir John French and Archibald Wavell, who were not thought up to the job, were replaced with more unswerving commanders such as Haig and Montgomery. As for the people, it is often said of the First World War, if members of the public had known of the carnage at the front, they would have insisted that it be stopped. The problem with this theory is that the people had a good idea of what was happening on the various fronts. The publication of lists of casualties by name by the press, helpfully totalled at the top of the page by such newspapers as the Glasgow Herald, and the sheer extent of the casualties demonstrated the true cost of the war. Certainly by 1916, very few families did not know of a close relative or loved one who had become a casualty. Then, for those curious to understand whether the great offensives were getting any closer to Berlin, the press published maps indicating that Berlin, even in 1918, was still some way off. Yet even with this knowledge, the extent of an anti-war movement in Britain was small, and though by 1917 war weariness had certainly set in, there was no strong call to end it. Indeed, there were stronger calls to prosecute it with more firmness. A similar spirit seemed to imbue those whose lot it was to prosecute this war at close range, the soldiers. Regardless of what one thinks of the sometimes futile campaigns in which they were required to participate, overwhelmingly they did so without resorting to widespread indiscipline. Day after day, whatever the hopelessness of the task set, they attacked again and again. Churchill, a stern critic of the methods used on the Western Front, could not but admire of the wonderful tenacity of the British soldier. Indeed, there is some kind of epic grandeur within the great tragedy of these endeavours. It is a matter for wonder that, of the Allied armies fighting on the Western Front and elsewhere, the British army was the only one that stuck to its task without mutiny or indeed reluctance to fight. What is remarkable about Britain in the Second World War is that, having endured the ordeal of 1914 to 1918, it went to war again in 1939. A claim is sometimes made that the policy of appeasement fed on the disillusionment with the Great War. But when appeasement was seen to equal dishonour, which after Munich it rapidly was, and when it was acknowledged that Hitler's aims were indeed unlimited, the mood became resolute for war, as a startled Chamberlain was late to realise. And when the people were tested with war directly, as they were in the Blitz, the mood was again uncompromising. They came out to see Churchill as he visited the bombed cities, not just to be cheered, but to check that his spirit remained as determined as theirs. As for the armies, they were sent out to fight in the Middle East, India, Burma, and many other places as well, where they spent years away from home and loved ones. That their morale was often low seems beyond dispute. That they fought on is definitely beyond dispute. Despite the resolution shown in Britain in both world wars, it must not be concluded that victory was a certainty. There were moments in the wars where victory might have turned into defeat, or at least a prolongation of the war to the depths of exhaustion. One such moment occurred on the 7th of November 1917, when Haig asked for over 1 million men to prolong his already disastrous campaign at Passchendaele into 1918. If such a policy had been pursued, the reserves, few enough as it happened, which stopped the German spring offensive in 1918, would have been consumed, and the British armies not just driven back, but perhaps defeated. Lloyd George refused the request, perhaps earning his sobriquet of the man who won the war. A similar decisive moment came in June 1942 during the Second World War. Then, an American delegation in London, led by General Marshall and with the full backing of President Roosevelt, insisted that an invasion of northwestern Europe take place in that year. The sooner, in fact, the better. Churchill, backed by his military advisers, refused, and as the British, under the American plan, would have been required to provide the bulk of the troops and the shipping, that was the end of the debate. If such an operation had gone ahead, it would almost certainly have led to a crushing defeat. The Allies not possessing the seasoned troops, nor the sophisticated landing craft, nor the practice at amphibious operations to carry it through to a success. What this would have meant for the war in the West and the eventual composition of Europe is highly speculative, but it would certainly have led to a prolongation of the war, with Britain playing an ever-diminishing part in its conclusion. There are many other such moments detailed in the course of the following narrative. They show that victory in a conflict the size of a world war is never a foregone conclusion. And the alternative, as far as Western Europe and indeed Britain were concerned, was that they could have finished up under the heel of the Kaiser's Germany, or even worse, as provinces of a Nazified Europe. Matters of world historical importance were therefore at stake in both conflicts. This book then takes its title, Conquer We Must, from the stern resolve exhibited by Britain in both world wars. The book concentrates on the political and military interface that decided where Britain would fight, with what resources it would fight, and how it would fight. The forums in which these decisions would be made had to be rapidly improvised in 1914, as fighting a world war was quite outside the experience of anyone in government. A kind of war council, where selected politicians and selected military advisers would gather together, was implemented with great speed, and the precedent followed, with some refinements in the Second World War. Luckily for the historian, it was also decided that such bodies would keep minutes and papers that have been almost entirely preserved for posterity. These documents allow us a bird's-eye view of decision-making at the highest level. For example, we can trace the decision to embark on various enterprises, including Gallipoli, the Somme, the war in the desert, and the Normandy landings. We can observe the cut and thrust of debates which the ventures engendered, and the way in which the final decision was made. Other documents allow us to see at first hand debates among coalition partners about which strategy to follow. This is particularly important in the Second World War, where the Americans take an increasingly prominent role. There we can see what compromises were reached, and those instances where compromises proved impossible. We can also see disputes shifting from those within a country to those between countries, as national interests clash and solidify. But we must record not merely high-level decision-making. The decisions taken in these forums resulted in fighting on the ground, many times in campaigns that stretched over long months or even years. It would be an anemic history that ignored the combat operations that flowed from these decisions. Detail of the fighting enables us to examine how well thought out the original decisions at the summit were, what price had to be paid, and whether the politicians had the will or the means of intervening if these military operations seemed to be going wrong. And what we know about a liberal state, Britain in 1914, or a democracy, Britain in 1939, is that if military operations were going wrong, the politicians had sanctions that they could apply to the military and expect to be obeyed. They could replace generals or order them to cease and desist from the methods they were employing. If they did not choose this course of action, we need to know why, and need to know the consequences for the men on the ground who were required to persist with unfruitful military operations. If they did order changes in command or method, we need to ask the same questions. Why was the change made, and what consequences were there for the soldiers? Again, some examples are in order. In 1915, a Liberal government, on the urging of Churchill, but with the ready acceptance of other members of the War Council, decided that the strategy being carried out was perhaps not the best way to win the war. Against the advice of their first Sea Lord, Jacky Fisher, they decided to attempt to bring down an empire and shorten the war by naval power alone, and when that operation failed, their Minister of War, Lord Kitchener, without consulting either civilian or military colleagues, decided to commit troops to the area, resulting in the rather futile and quite costly Gallipoli campaign. This was civilian intervention with a vengeance. By contrast, in 1916, having decided on the Somme campaign, the Civilian War Committee decided to accept the advice of the military and to persist with it despite the enormous casualty bill, the obvious fact that the battle was not progressing according to plan, and despite the palpable nonsense they were being fed by their top military adviser, General Robertson. This was civilian dereliction with a vengeance. The Second World War represents a different scenario. Both Chamberlain and Churchill were interventionists, the difference being that Chamberlain would intervene to confine military operations to a minimum, his decision to drop leaflets on Germany instead of bombs being one of the more well-known, while Churchill's interventions were almost always of the opposite type, where he insisted on incessant attacks, whether commanders were ready for them or not. Clashes of personality are commonplace in politicians and not unknown among soldiers. In war, especially World War, these clashes have a heightened importance because issues of survival are at stake. We are fortunate that many of the key players, though not any of the four prime ministers, kept diaries. For the First World War, we have the diaries of Maurice Hankey, secretary of the variously named war councils, and for the military we have that of Sir Douglas Haig. This diary has been described as the longest suicide note in history, but it shows like nothing else in this conflict the pressures under which a high-level commander, and then commander-in-chief, worked. It shows the war from his perspective, a narrow focus, it has been called, as though between the ears of a horse. But it is wide-ranging enough and candid enough to provide an unrivalled view of General Headquarters, GHQ, at work. It also shows the bitter disputes between Haig and Lloyd George, though here we need Hankey's diary and the minutes of the various forums in which Haig and Lloyd George clashed to gain a true perspective. For the Second World War, we have Alan Brooke's diary, in many ways the equivalent of Haig's. Here, clashes with Churchill are almost a daily event, though their differences in strategy are on most occasions not as far apart as Brooke asserts. We also have Harold Nicholson's unparalleled view of the parliamentary Churchill at war and the gossipy, if rather repellent, diaries of a Conservative backbencher, Chips Channon, now in an expanded form. We also have the Roosevelt-Churchill correspondence, one of the key sources for the development of Allied strategy in the Second World War. This is particularly important because Roosevelt was not an inveterate writer like Churchill, and his correspondence with the Prime Minister provides the best source for his thinking. This relationship, even before the US became an active partner in the war, is in some ways the best introduction to the sometimes ambivalent partnership Britain had with its great ally, and the benefits and costs that such an association brought about. The fascinating interplay between politicians and the military, the force of the personalities involved, and the transcending importance of the issues at stake make the study of Britain in two world wars worthy of attention. It also provides a fruitful opportunity for comparison. Was anything learned from one war to the next? Was Churchill the beneficiary of events from the earlier conflict, where in 1915 he was unceremoniously removed from office? Did Britain fight a more efficient Second World War than the first? And if so, was that experience accountable for it? The two world wars are therefore a lens through which to see Britain in its last, best role as a great power. The choices it made during that period, and its ultimate survival, live with us still. Chapter 1. A Liberal State Declares War. At 4 p.m. on Sunday the 28th of June 1914, the Foreign Office received a report from Consul Jones in Sarajevo. According to news received here, Heir Apparent and his consort assassinated this morning by means of an explosive nature. Later that evening, the news arrived from the British ambassador that Franz Ferdinand and the Duchess Sophie had in fact been shot by a young Serbian student. 37 days later, Britain and Germany were at war. What is remarkable about Britain during this period is that not a single military figure had the slightest influence on policy. The country went to war because the Cabinet and the House of Commons decided that it must. Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, as was appropriate, was the first to react to the murders. He expressed his condolences to the Austrian Emperor through the ambassador, and he expressed his sympathy to the Austrian ambassador in London, Count Mensdorf, noting that every feeling, political and personal, makes me sympathise with you. Grey was not at this stage particularly perturbed. What happened in the Balkans, he said, was not our concern, a position he maintained throughout the crisis. Certainly, if the incident remained localised, Britain would have no interest. Indeed, it is difficult to think of an area of the world in which Britain was less interested. Trade with the area was minimal, defence links, except with the Greek Navy, nil. British representation was minuscule. There was an embassy in Serbia and one in Romania that covered the remainder of the Balkans, that was all. Recent events, however, had demonstrated how the great powers could be drawn into Balkan affairs. In 1912, war broke out between the Balkan states led by Serbia and Turkey. A second war followed in 1913 between Serbia, Romania and Bulgaria as they sought to redistribute land taken from the Ottomans in the first war for themselves. Austria sought to intervene in this conflict, mainly to prevent the emergence of an enlarged Serbia, which they feared might act as a magnet to the Slav populations living within their empire. Russia, which saw itself as the guardian of Slav interests in the Balkans, warned the Austrians to back off. On this occasion, the war was confined. Grey, with German encouragement, called an ambassador's conference in London. Protracted negotiations, punctuated by outbreaks of fighting in the Balkans, followed. Eventually, Grey, with the general approval of Germany, France and Russia, shouted at the assembled Balkan representatives, "Sign or go." They signed. Great power solidarity had won through. Austria would have to live with a greater Serbia. Russia was mollified. Grey's first intimation that the assassination of the Archduke might also have implications for the powers arrived via a cable from the British ambassador in Vienna, Sir Maurice de Bunsen. On the 2nd of July, he warned Grey that the murders would see a period of great tension between the two countries. The Austrians thought that, if the assassinations were not planned in Belgrade, the plans certainly found favour there. Was this the first step towards an even greater Serbia at the expense of the Slav populations of Austria? Due to the vagaries of the diplomatic cable traffic in those far-off days, this telegram only arrived at the Foreign Office on the 6th of July. It was perhaps its arrival that prompted Grey to seek an interview with the German ambassador to Britain, Prince Lichnowsky. It is interesting that Grey sought out Lichnowsky rather than Count Mensdorf, the Austrian ambassador. Clearly the Foreign Secretary was thinking that the crisis might be managed by a rerun of the methods used in the Balkan Wars. Germany would act as a restraint on Austria, while Britain and France could use their influence on Russia. On this occasion, Grey was to be disappointed. Lichnowsky had just returned to London from Berlin. He reported that the anti-Serb feeling in Austria was very strong, but more alarming was the mood in the German capital. There was a feeling that Germany could not ask for restraint from its main ally again. In any case, some in Berlin were nervous about the increases in the size of the Russian army and concerned that Russia had signed some kind of naval convention with Britain. Men with close ties with the military were saying, Lichnowsky told Grey in the utmost confidence, that if Austria saw fit to punish the Serbs and Russia intervened to protect them, Germany should stand up for its ally. Better a war now than later against an even stronger Russia. Grey sought to reassure Lichnowsky. He had heard nothing from Russia to indicate ill will towards Germany. There had been no naval convention signed between Britain and Russia, merely conversations between naval authorities. All must work to pacify the Austrian-Serb situation. They would meet again for further talks. Despite his calm outward demeanour, this talk with Lichnowsky thoroughly alarmed Grey. He immediately arranged a meeting with Count Benkendorf, the Russian ambassador to Britain, who happened to be Lichnowsky's cousin, to establish if there was any reason for German fear of Russia. Benkendorf assured him there was no indication whatever from St. Petersburg of ill will towards Germany. He went on to say, however, that the increase in the Russian army in recent years was an undoubted fact that might have fueled German fears. Grey urged him to reassure Germany that no one was preparing any kind of coup against it. This the ambassador promised to do, noting that Grey had said that the idea that the terrible crime might unexpectedly produce a general war with all its attendant catastrophes made his hair stand on edge. Had Grey been aware of events in Berlin and Vienna that had taken place at the time of these interviews, his hair would not have stood on edge. It would have fallen out. Count Berchtold, the Austrian foreign minister, and Konrad, the Austrian chief of staff, had pushed for war against Serbia since the time of the assassination. The emperor was not so certain. Austria could not move without Germany's backing. Would it be given? Franz Joseph therefore insisted that a mission be dispatched to Berlin to find out. The mission would be conducted by Count Alexander Hoyos, the chief of the foreign minister's private office. He was to convey two documents to the Germans, long and rambling affairs, which in their essence made the case for war. Hoyos arrived at the Wilhelmstrasse on the very day that Grey met with Lichnowsky, the 6th of July. During the next 2 days, Hoyos saw Zimmermann, the Under-Secretary of State, the foreign minister. Jago was on honeymoon in Switzerland, while the Austrian ambassador to Germany, Count Zirgeny, presented the same documents to the Kaiser. Later, both men met the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. What transpired at these meetings has engaged historians for decades. However, the main tenor is clear. Both the Kaiser and the Chancellor left the Austrians in no doubt that the German government was in favour of an immediate offensive on our part against Serbia. In other words, the Germans were committed to back Austria at the very moment that Grey was attempting to invoke them as mediator. The blank check had been issued. Grey knew nothing of these manoeuvres, but his suspicions that Austria intended to take stern action against Serbia were confirmed on the 16th of July. On that day, he learned from de Bunsen that a friend, in fact Count Lützow, a former Austrian ambassador to Italy, was aware that a kind of indictment is being prepared in Vienna against the Serbian government for alleged complicity in the conspiracy which led to the assassination of the Archduke. The informant went on to say that the Austrians were in no mood to parley with the Serbians, that they would require unconditional compliance with their indictment, failing which force will be used, and that Germany was in complete agreement with this procedure. This was escalation. Germany was now in the mix, not as a mediator but as a backer of its ally in any military action that Austria might take. Nevertheless, the nature of the Austrian indictment was not known. There was still time to urge caution on the powers. Grey therefore began another round of diplomatic conversations. First, he told the British ambassador in St. Petersburg, Sir George Buchanan, that it was important to keep the Austrians and the Russians talking. If Austria could show good justification for any demands it made on Belgrade, and if the powers concentrated on the wider issue of the peace of Europe, the situation might be contained. Next, he called in Benkendorf and urged him to ask the Russian foreign minister, Sazonov, to initiate talks between the Russians and Austria. Sazonov should emphasise that the strength of pro-Slav feeling in Russia meant that there was widespread sympathy for Serbia, but that if the Austrians took the Russians into their confidence and laid before them the case they had against Serbia, any reasonable demands might be met. Grey then called in Lichnowsky and asked if he had any details of the step Austria might take against Serbia. Lichnowsky informed him that he had not, which was correct, because his own government was keeping him out of the Balkan loop. Lichnowsky, however, told Grey that he was very apprehensive about the belligerence of the Austrians. Grey passed on these sentiments to the British ambassador in Berlin and authorised him to say that the Austrians must keep their demands within reasonable limits. Then the powers would be well placed to urge restraint on Russia. Finally, Grey saw the French ambassador to Britain, Paul Cambon. He told him of the apprehensions of the German ambassador and that he was uncertain of the role the Germans were playing in the Balkan dispute. Probably, he told Cambon, Berlin was trying to moderate Vienna. Grey was not being entirely straightforward with Cambon here. He kept from him any hint that Germany might be playing a double game, urging Austria on in private while publicly calling for peace. Grey clearly still had hopes that Germany might in the end restrain its ally. In the meantime, Grey thought that the most direct method of restraining Russia lay with its ally France, but that the French might be reluctant to act if they were suspicious of German motives. In this period we see Grey follow a conciliatory path. He had by no means ruled out some form of reparation to Austria from Serbia for the outrage. He also communicated the same message to all the powers, be reasonable and keep talking. And it is noteworthy that he took this line as strongly with his Entente partners as he did with the representatives of the Central Powers. Grey was certainly involved in a perilous balancing act, and this act became much more difficult on the 23rd of July. On that day, Mensdorf had seen Grey to give him advance warning of the nature of the Austrian notes to Serbia, no doubt in order to cushion the blow. He led Grey to understand that the note would consist of a long list of demands with which Serbia was expected to comply. He then told Grey that there will be a time limit attached to the note. Grey interrupted and told the Austrian ambassador that this converted the note into an ultimatum, that it would inflame opinion in Russia, and that in these circumstances it would be very difficult for the Entente powers to urge restraint. Grey concluded by saying to Mensdorf that the possible consequences of the present situation were terrible. If as many as four great powers of Europe, let us say Austria, France, Russia, and Germany, note that Grey was prudently giving nothing away as to the position of Britain, were engaged in war, it seemed to me that it must involve the expenditure of so vast a sum of money and such an interference with trade that a war would be accompanied or followed by a complete collapse of European credit and industry. In these days in great industrial states, this would mean a state of things worse than that of 1848, and irrespective of who were victors in the war, many things might be completely swept away. Statesmen have been accused of marching towards war in this period without realising the consequences. If that is the case, Sir Edward Grey must be excluded from their number. On the 24th of July, Grey saw the ultimatum. He told the British ambassador to Austria that he considered it the most formidable document I had ever seen addressed by one state to another that was independent. The merits or otherwise of the Austrian case did not interest him. It was the whole tone of the note that caused alarm. In Grey's view, it amounted to an ultimatum designed to be rejected. In particular, he noted that demand number 5 would have allowed Austrian-appointed officials to have judicial authority on Serbian territory, hardly consistent with maintenance of independent sovereignty of Serbia. Not that Grey was all that interested in that either. Why should he be? Britain's national interests were hardly engaged. What did worry him was the threat the ultimatum posed to the peace of Europe. For if Serbian territorial integrity was threatened, Russia might intervene. And if the Germans were standing behind the Austrians, an intervention by Russia to assist Serbia might trigger a German intervention to assist Austria. All this was made of immediate urgency because a 48-hour time limit had been attached to the note. Within 2 days, the four great powers might be at war. In this situation, Britain might be reduced, at best, to the position of a bystander watching over the destruction of European trade. At worst, dragged into a conflict, the origins of which lay outside Britain's zone of interest. Grey now repeated the tactics he had employed after the assassination. He saw the relevant ambassadors and advised that talks between Austria and Russia were essential. This time he went one step further. He suggested that he was thinking of calling a conference or a meeting of the four least interested powers, Germany, France, Russia, and Britain, to discuss the assassination crisis and to hammer out a settlement. But later in the day, the German embassy issued a communication which made their participation in such a conference highly unlikely. The communique stated that Germany regarded the Austrian demands as equitable and moderate. If the terms of the ultimatum were not met, then Austria would have no choice but to use military measures against the Serbs. With a solid front of the powers on the brink of dissolution, Grey suggested to Asquith that the cabinet be immediately brought together. Some authorities have intimated that Gray should have consulted his colleagues at a much earlier date than...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?